This episode of Metatrex is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice and to help Trek FM at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space, an international program of the nonprofit National Space Society. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter by visiting enterpriseinspace.org. Want to join the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field. We look forward to seeing you there.
This is Tim Russ, Lieutenant Commander Tuvok on Star Trek Voyager, and you're listening to Trek FM.
There's no greater challenge than the study of philosophy.
My philosophy is that there is room for all philosophies on this station.
Well, welcome everyone to episode 96 of Metatrex, Trek FM show on Star Trek and philosophy. My name is Mike Morrison, and with me, as he always is Zachary Frühling. Today we'll be discussing our choices for Essential Trek Philosophy from Star Trek Enterprise Season 1. Zachary.
You mean Enterprise Season 1 or Star Trek Enterprise Season 1?
That is a very good question. A very good question indeed.
We've retronamed it.
Yes, we retronamed it. Enterprise is obviously it's the series, Zachary, I think, of the two of us that I'm mostly fond. You're the Voyager guy. I'm the Enterprise guy, and I would like to say that I'm really, really excited about this particular podcast getting to talk about Enterprise, but this is a tough season.
I remember when Enterprise first premiered. I was in my first year of grad school at Syracuse University, and September 11th had just happened when this first episode premiered a couple weeks before. And for some reason, I just associate the two together. And what we didn't realize at the time, of course, was how much an event like September 11th would actually influence what Enterprise became, mm-hmm. None of which happened in season one, because season one was already fairly well fleshed out. Scripts were written, filming had begun. I don't know how far in the production of season one they'd got by the time September 11th had happened, but enough to where September 11th didn't really influence season one of Enterprise. And it was really a bright spot because it was a terrible time for our country. And I remember just being so excited that there was going to be a new Star Trek series. There was this palpable excitement to it, and I watched the premiere episode, and I loved it. And then I didn't really finish watching the entire season, partly because I just got busy with grad school, and partly because it didn't capture me as much as I hoped it would. But I actually, the parts I do remember from my first viewing of season one, I really thoroughly enjoyed. But I had a hard time thinking about Essential Trek Philosophy from season one of Enterprise because I didn't really enjoy it for the philosophy. And some Star Trek I do, like TNG, I really enjoy for the philosophy. And some episodes of Voyager I really enjoy. And Deep Space Nine, definitely I enjoy for the philosophy. Enterprise, I think they're like philosophical quick hits. You know, there some episodes are brilliant philosophically, but I really like the themes of season one and some of the themes of Enterprise in general. But the themes of season one for me spoke to me, but I hesitate to call them philosophical themes.
Yeah, I agree. There's lots of good stuff, I think, in season one of Enterprise. There are lots of these little nuggets, if you will, of philosophy. But I think that it's muddied, by and large, by a show that was really trying to find its way. Mike Sussman was very influential in the writing room, the writer's room, I should say. And, you know, Sussman famously wasn't really crazy about message stories. And so I think that maybe by design, these aren't really heavily influenced in philosophy. So I think that might have had something to do with it. And again, I think that Enterprise was a show really trying to find its way. As much as I love Enterprise, I would have to say probably of the four series that preceded it, it it has the weakest, I think, season one.
Oh, well, I would say it's not as philosophically rich as season one of TNG. I'm constantly impressed by the philosophical content in the first season of Star Trek The Next Generation, even though season one had its problems dramatically and with character development and some of the writing in season one. But the philosophical content in season one of that series is dense and rich. Season one of Enterprise, not so much. I do want to spend some time talking about the overall themes of season one before we dive into our episode picks. But again, I don't know if I enjoy season one for its philosophical content. I feel like I had to scrape the bottom of the barrel a little bit to come up with episode picks. But I do appreciate that Enterprise was trying to... Well, I think, first of all, be different than what had come before it. You know, before Enterprise, we had all of TNG, all of Deep Space Nine, mm-hmm. and all of Voyager. So 1990s Trek was pretty well fleshed out, and they'd been there and done that. It got to be a little repetitive at a certain point. So I appreciate that Enterprise purposely wanted to take Star Trek a different direction. They didn't want to just do another Voyager or another TNG. And that's, I think, how a lot of people think about TV development now. They don't want to just do another, even with the Picard series come up, they don't want to just do another TNG. They want to take it a different direction, right. Which is a shame in a way for those of us that grew up loving 1990s Star Trek. You know, some people on a ship exploring a new culture, solving an ethical dilemma, exploring some scientific concept, sort of a quick hit little a mini drama on that topic and moving on, highly episodic with that kind of positive week by week by week tone to it. I miss that a little bit. And every time someone says, I'm going to take Star Trek a new direction, I'm one of these people that rolls my eyes a little bit and goes, oh, do we have to? It was really, they made brilliant stuff for all three of those series and it was working. Even Gene Roddenberry said, you can tell those stories till the end of time because there's always some new aspect of the human condition to explore.
Yes.
So there's that kind of storytelling would never get old by definition. Dramatically, it might get old, but conceptually, it's not going to get old. So I'm not one of these people that feels like Star Trek ever needed to veer in a different direction, but I was happy with the direction Enterprise went in season one. I like this idea of maybe getting back to Star Trek as being out there on the edge of the frontier. It's rolling back the clock a little bit, you know, looking 100 years before the original series. That means the frontier is not as far from Earth.
Right.
So there's not as much unknown, but it's an interesting dramatic experience to imagine, you know, you Captain Archer and company as the crew of the first Warp 5 starship out there on what was then, 100 years before the original series, the frontier, and all those wagon train to the stars elements you would expect being out there on the frontier. All the dangers and all of the politics and all of the negotiating and all of the trying to survive.
Mm-hmm.
And 1990s Star Trek got a little... safe, as you know, the Alpha Quadrant was a safe place to be by the time TNG rolled around.
Yeah.
Generally, other than, you know, if you're on the frontier, on the border between the Federation and the Romulan Empire, maybe that's a dangerous place to be if you're in the neutral zone. But if you're in the Alpha Quadrant, bebopping around, ferrying diplomats around, it's a safe place to be. So I did like the idea of getting back to the frontier. And I also liked the way in which it tried to bring Star Trek a little closer to us. If you look at Star Trek's origin in the 1960s and look at all the developments that happened in the previous 50 years, say from 1915 to 1965 or 66, right? The world changed immensely in that amount of time. And same thing in the next 50 years, you know, for us 100 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So you can project yourself a few hundred years into the future and go, just imagine what the world's going to be like in 300 years, given all the change that happened in the 20th century. So, but it's still kind of far out there. You know, the world that we see in Star Trek is pretty far removed from our day-to-day world that we live in.
Yeah.
So I like this attempt to bring Star Trek a little closer to our 20th and 21st century, well, 21st century at that point, 21st century point of view, you know, imagining that in not too far of a time, you know, 100 years or 150 years, whatever the number is, I always forget the math, you know, how far ahead of Star Trek in the future, I forget. You know, that sounds a little more plausible than 300 or 400 years in the future. Just barely getting to the point where we can invent something resembling a starship and getting out there in interstellar space. That's something maybe we could achieve in a lifetime or two. And I like Enterprise's attempt to just bring Star Trek a little closer to us, something we could relate to and see as a possible future for ourselves.
Yeah, when I say season one was a little weaker, I'm talking about the philosophical content in terms of the entertainment value, in terms of the stories that they were telling. I love it. I loved the Quantum Leap guy as the captain. That was for me.
that was cool.
That was cool. And I love the fact that we went backward instead of forward. And I realize that there are a lot of fans out there, a lot of fans who hate the fact that we went backward. They wanted to go even further forward from Voyager. They wanted to continue to go into the future. And I understand that. I want to validate that as a legitimate, you know, desire and a point of view. But for a lot of fans, you know, we just didn't tire of, you know, that Star Trek that, as you put it, it was a little bit closer to where we are now. You know, for me, it was getting to see a little bit of that evolution or that metamorphosis from where we are to, you know, where certainly I began as a fan with the original series. You know, what happened in that time period from now until, you know, Kirk, Spock, and McCoy, that we got to tell some of those stories. And honestly, I didn't get enough of that in four seasons of Enterprise. I would have loved to have seen a space boomer series where we're on a ship and they're just shuttling stuff back and forth to colonists. I would have watched that show to see a little bit about what that lifestyle was like. It's kind of like, you know, a cargo ship captain out there, a truck driver.
Okay, that's a great idea. I would love to see a Star Trek series about a super tiny, you know, shuttlecraft-sized cargo ship.
Yes. Yes, I totally wanted to watch that because I'm interested in the stories of the frontier. And I think it's partly because of my love of history. I love to read historical documents, and I love to read these kind of retellings, if you will, and biographies, anything that kind of puts me into the life of someone in the early days of our country, you know, out there on the frontier trying to make a go of it. I'm intrigued by those stories. And so it's no different at taking it kind of into the future and looking at it from the aspects of space. And I feel like we got that with Enterprise. It just was philosophically, I think, lacking.
Well, every revolution of this variety in our history has necessitated some cultural change or forced cultural change, whether it's westward expansion, whether it's technological developments. You know, you could look at communication technologies like telegraph or telephone or the internet. You could look at transportation technologies, you know, the development of the automobile, mm-hmm. the railroad, whatever it is. You know, each one of those changes the world around it. And then all of a sudden we get interstellar travel, you know, to a higher degree. You know, I guess there were warp ships before the warp 5 ship.
Yeah, the Enterprise was our first deep space warp ship, and that was cool. But what about the warp 2 cargo ships?
Well, every time there's a radical boost in either communication or in transportation, the world and in Star Trek, the galaxy gets a little smaller. you end up with a multicultural, multinational, you know, international world, a global world that we didn't have before, and not to the degree we do now. In Star Trek, that means you don't just have your little corner of the galaxy with your tiny little, you know, warp one ships that barely get outside your solar system. You know, all of a sudden you live in a galactic community, and all of the conflict and world changes and, you know, negotiations and cultural adjustments that that it takes to have a galactic melting pot start to mm-hmm. ensue. So it is interesting to see this idea that you know, really you're going to end up with something like a galactic melting pot. You know, and TNG was all very already worked out. All those things had happened. Everyone had already learned to play nice with each other. But one of the fun things for me to see in Enterprise Season 1 was this, and maybe it's a theme, unity through diversity.
Yeah. Right?
You've got Andorians and Vulcans and humans and other races that would become part of the Federation. And they're not all friends yet. And it's fun to see this very Star Trek principle that through this radical diversity and strife and conflict between these different races, a unified vision can emerge out of that. And Enterprise really wanted to show how that works.
Right. Yeah, I agree completely. But again, back to my idea about this Space Boomer show. Archer's still diplomatically trained. But you have to realize that, you know, before we got that first deep space vessel out there, first contacts were being made by boomers. You know, they were cargo vessel captains that were making some of those first contacts. And what did that look like when, you know, nobody's diplomatically trained? They're just out there. They're just, you know, they're hauling their stuff and they just happen to bump into people. It's this really cool slice of life kind of thing. I think we got a little bit of that with Enterprise, which I find very intriguing. You know, for instance, I think the fact that we got a different take on the Vulcans, I think was extremely interesting. You know, here's this society that, you know, always seems to be one step ahead of us in every other Star Trek series. And we get to see that, you know, there's kind of this dark underbelly of this culture, this society. They're not quite as evolved and they're a little bit afraid of us. And I find that very interesting.
Well, I'm hesitant to say that Vulcans were always portrayed in a positive light. I mean, even in the original series, I'm thinking of, is it Amok Time?
Mm-hmm.
When Spock has to fight for his life. And right, that episode. I can never remember the titles. In that episode, Vulcans, I don't think, are portrayed in a particularly positive light. So, but by the time TNG happened, Vulcans were relatively idealized Vulcans.
Yeah.
So it was fun to go back and look at Vulcans as proto-TNG Vulcans that still had some rough edges.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. I find that extremely interesting. We got to explore some of those foundational species like the Andorians and the Tellarites. Not nearly enough, in my opinion. But the fact that we're able to explore some of those different species and kind of take a look at how those relationships evolved, I find it interesting. I found it interesting when it first aired. I still find it interesting. I love Enterprise. It's just philosophically, we're kind of light here in season one.
Yeah, it has this kind of universe-building quality to it. You know, we have the Star Trek universe as it was portrayed in the 1990s. We had the Star Trek universe as it was portrayed in the original series. And there's this gap between them. And, you know, obviously they just wanted to fill in the gaps and flesh out the universe a little bit. The challenge for that, I think, is that usually when you're universe building, you want new races and you want new characters. And, you know, it's like it's... I could see they want to flesh out the history a little bit, fill in the gap. And it kind of has this universe building quality to it because you are fleshing out the backstories and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, constantly going back to races that we already know maybe failed from that universe building perspective.
Right, right.
I mean, we have Denobulans and, you know, some new races, of course. But I think they didn't have that universe building quality that, I think we saw it in Voyager. I mean, all the new races we get in Voyager, I think, are much more successful from a universe-building standpoint than what we see in Enterprise from that standpoint.
Yeah. I just know with all of these new shows that are coming out, I really hope at some point they'll take us back a little bit in history. I mean, we're 130 years, I think it is, removed from Enterprise. So I'd like to know how we get from here to there as it were.
I think you and I, we need to challenge ourselves over the next year or two as we keep recording new episodes of Metatrex. And we're almost episode 100. Can you believe it? We're on episode 96. Can you imagine 4 years ago when we started this podcast that we would be at near at episode 100? We planned to do it a couple of years ago. we just don't seem to be able to record that often. But we need to challenge ourselves, I think, to focus on newer Star Trek a bit. Let's spend a little more time on Discovery. Let's definitely record some stuff about Star Trek Picard and the other new Star Trek series that are coming.
Yeah.
Let's expand our own philosophical horizons a bit. The other thing that came to mind for me as I was thinking about overall themes in Enterprise Season 1, maybe Enterprise in general, are the opening credits. The opening credits portray a very inspiring but linear notion of human progress.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it's portrayed like visually before your very eyes. Little scientific improvements here and there, you know, building better and better starships, better and better modes of travel.
Right.
Different things named Enterprise. Yeah, I like the intermediate forms, like, you know, what comes between the, you know, the space shuttle and the Zefram Cockrum's,
right,
you know, warp ship. That's, you know, those kinds of transition forms. It's almost, you know what it is? It's like, it's an evolutionary history. You get this in natural evolution, like in biology, right? You get intermediate forms in paleontology. And in the last 20 years in paleontology, we've fleshed out intermediate forms in ways we never thought possible when I was a kid, you know, reading about dinosaur evolution and whatnot. But really what we're seeing is the evolution of Star Trek before our very eyes, as if it were the evolution of organisms here on Earth.
Yeah.
It's fascinating to me. But it portrays human progress in a very, I don't know, I would call it simplistic and linear kind of term. Future generations learn more than previous generations. They build stuff that's better, and on and on and on we go into the future. And certain philosophers of science, like Thomas Kuhn, have questioned the notion that scientific progress is cumulative in that way. It's more a matter of paradigm shifts from one paradigm to another, like from Newtonian physics to relativistic physics to quantum mechanics. You know, while technology might be progressive in that sense, our scientific understanding of the world doesn't seem to happen in that linear kind of sense. And indeed, I think we see cultural backslides. I don't think you can say human culture is on the same forward trajectory that technology is.
Right.
So it paints progress in a very positive, very simplistic, very linear kind of way that I think doesn't really do justice to the nature of human change over the generations. It's inspiring, without a doubt. I was inspired by the credits. I thought they were fun and interesting.
Yeah.
I didn't care whether they put words in there. You know, some people objected to the fact there were lyrics in it, but I liked it. That was an inspiring opening credit. I think they did an amazing job with it. But philosophically, I think it fails because it doesn't do justice to the complexity of change over time, especially culturally and politically, in favor of technological progress. But that's always been Star Trek's ethos, right? Technological progress drives human progress. You know, the obtainment of full human potential.
Yes. Yeah. And there are these little bits of dialogue throughout, especially season one, where, you know, for instance, Tucker is, you know, regaling about the fact that, you know, hey, we've wiped out starvation and, you know, we've progressed and we, you know, we've done this culturally and we've done this and humanity is evolving and coming into its own and,
replicate me some trout.
Yeah, I just want to know how they did it, you know? I just want to know how they did it. You know, it's like, okay, so we wiped out starvation. How did we do that? What'd that look like? I want to see that show. I want to see that episode. And we got to do that a couple of times. In fact, I love the fact that there are these moments in Enterprise where we do kind of go back in time in the series. But we did that with Voyager, and we did that, you know, so I don't know. I didn't get enough of it. I love that type of storytelling. I love the fact that they weren't afraid at this point in time. You know, here we are post 9/11, kind of taking things back and winding it back. I think it was timely, certainly, to kind of bridge the gap. And I think they were at least trying to show, as the lyrics suggested, how we got from there to here in the Star Trek universe, and maybe give a little bit of hope to not just a country, you know, that was trying to, you know, find its footing again, but, you know, to the world, you know, that's kind of on this this new frontier of, you know, cultural awakening.
An interesting question for me is, what would have happened with Enterprise had September 11th not occurred? Because the whole Zindi arc is essentially a September 11th metaphor.
Sure.
Explicitly. I mean, it's classic. In a way, it's a brilliant classic Star Trek social commentary and political commentary. But had that not happened, what directions might they have taken Enterprise in that would have been a natural consequence of what we saw in season one that would serve that filling in the gap between the original series and where we are, you know, today, a couple hundred years before. I'm just curious what your thoughts are on this. Like, what direction might they have gone with the later seasons of Enterprise if September 11th just never occurred and that wasn't a part of our history and there was no need to take the show that direction.
Yeah, you mentioned season three being heavily influenced, and it certainly was. I think season three of Enterprise was
unsubtly
directly influenced by what was going on in our world at the time.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing? I mean, some people think that's the core of Star Trek. Star Trek is social commentary. I don't know. I mean, maybe having to do it in an entire season for me just felt heavy-handed, but
yeah.
Maybe in one episode about that would have been fine.
I saw influences of September 11th really in the second season, and even in some of the later episodes of season one, I saw some examples of just subtle storytelling that I think was influenced by September 11th. I really don't have an answer to the question other than to say we certainly wouldn't have had the season three that I don't think the Zindi arc would have ever.
Oh yeah, there would be no reason to. But I have to give the writer some credit though. Like, usually this kind of self-reflective social commentary happens quite a few years after the fact. Like, you start getting World War II movies, not in 1947, but you start to get them in the 50s and 60s and onward, right? It takes a decade or so to really get some good social commentary going on. It's amazingly timely for the writers to have started incorporating September 11th themes a year or two after September 11th. That is Johnny on the spot.
Yeah, for sure. For sure, but I think it was necessary. I even see some of those influences, Zachary, in some of the later episodes of season one. And honestly, those were really, I'm looking at my list right now. I've got three essentials and one honorable mention, and they're all in the back half of the season. And I see some moments there, I think, that were influenced by September 11th and other things that were going on in the world at the time. I would say Enterprise as a whole was kind of on the nose social commentary. It was very timely.
I'm getting the sense that your episode picks coming up are very different than mine.
So yours were early in the season.
They were, I think, generally.
Okay, yeah. Well, why don't we just dive in and start us out?
Sure. So my first choice for a Central Trek philosophy from season one of Enterprise is Terra Nova.
Okay.
Very early in the season.
Yes.
It's one of my favorite episodes of Enterprise in general. Why is it one of my favorites philosophically? Again, for me, these are all a little bit of a stretch philosophically. What I enjoy about Enterprise is not so much the philosophy. I like the concepts and the themes and the bridging the gap between our time frame and the original series. So take all of these with a little bit of a grain of salt. So if you remember, Terra Nova is the episode where a human colony has disappeared. You know, they've been out there, I forget how many years, 100 years or something. Maybe not that long, 60 years. I forget how many years it was. And but the colony's essentially disappeared. Like, they haven't been heard from. So now we have a Warp 5 ship that's able to get out where they were supposed to be quickly, and they can check on this colony. And we find that it's the descendants of this colony that have kind of, I don't know how to put it. There was a disaster, and the descendants are all sort of culturally unaware. It's almost like they're going back to the state of nature. It's like Lord of the Flies in a way, where it's, you know, just these immediate descendants of the original colonists who basically had to grow up without any human connection, very isolated, you know, having to invent their own culture and invent their own language with these remnants, like minuscule remnants of their heritage from the previous generation that all died out. It's fascinating to me. But the reason I put it on my list is, in fact, I was talking about this very subject today in my intro to philosophy class. I was talking about the state of nature and political philosophy, John Locke and Thomas Hobbes
yeah.
and their competing views on the origin of government and the origin of social contracts and how our political philosophy is a consequence of their view of our state of nature, man's natural state in a pre-civilized society. And I think I like just seeing what humankind is when it's stripped of all the things that humanity relies on. It's hard for any civilized, you know, philosopher to think of. You know, we are part of societies, and we do have laws and governments and rights and social contracts. And it's hard to kind of imagine what a pre-societal human nature would be like. Is that something fundamentally friendly, like it was for John Locke, where you have life and liberty and you till the land and own the fruits of your labor and all the natural rights that go along with those things?
Or eat digger meat.
Yeah, or eat digger meat. Or is it nasty, brutish, and short, like Thomas Hobbes thought the state of nature was, where it's a war of everyone against everyone, fighting for survival, mm-hmm. worrying about being killed and worried about your food being taken, and that kind of view of a state of nature. So for me, this is just an interesting glimpse at what humanity reverts to when left to its own devices. It's not an essential part of the episode. It's not the main focus of the episode. They don't draw that concept out philosophically, but it's at least an attempt to portray what humans are like when you strip away all of these societal and cultural and political factors that shape our day-to-day lives. And, yeah, in a way, it's kind of a useful fiction. Even in those philosophers I mentioned, the state of nature is arguably just a useful fiction, a postmodern narrative used right. to justify their own views. And all we can do from our point of view is kind of look back at ancient cultures and, you know, run the clock back and imagine what humans would be like in these small tribal bands before there were modern societies at all, pre-societal humans. Or proto-societal humans. And I just like that we get some glimpse of what humanity reverts to and left to its own devices in this episode. And to me, that calls to mind these political philosophies that rely on the state of nature, humans, in their proto-societal form.
Yeah, and I did a long list when I was putting my list of essentials together. I came up with 8 episodes. This was on my long list. And the reason I took it off is because, honestly, it's the episode, Zachary, is shale. Utter shale.
What?
It's utter shale. No, I'm kidding. I actually like this episode, but my problem with it and where it really falls flat for me mm-hmm. is this idea that in a generation, literally a generation, you know, this society really reverts to something that is very primal. And they have completely kind of lost touch with just basic education. I mean,
in the span of a generation.
So for me, it just doesn't seem reasonable. There's no logic to it. I think North Star from Enterprise season 3 was probably a better representation. This was these were people that were captured during the period of the American West, and they didn't progress. But they didn't revert either, Zachary. And so for me, this episode just kind of falls flat because literally in a generation, they've regressed. They've de-evolved as a society. And I just don't find that realistic. I agree with you that I think that it's an interesting look at what kind of a de-evolved society would look like. But the fact that they de-evolved in a generation, it's shale.
You think they could be at least? You think they'd at least have kept as much of their society together as the Irish farmers on the Mariposa that we saw in TNG?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a great example. I mentioned North Star from Enterprise season 3. We've kind of seen this done where there's no progress, but
but it was less like those examples and more like Lord of the Flies, right? You've got the parents all died off, the adults died, and it was the children who were left over, right?
Yeah.
So they didn't have upbringing, they didn't have culture, they didn't have all the things that people pass down from one generation to another. All of that, you know, was eliminated in an instant or, you know, not in a short time frame, and the children had to reinvent those on their own to some degree. So does that make it more plausible? For me, it shows how fragile society really is. If you take away all of our technological advances, if the economy collapses, if people stop passing things down to their children, you know, in ways that we expect them to, you know, what happens to society? I think this episode to some extent is saying humans, we revert pretty quickly when we don't make an effort not to revert.
Yeah. I just don't think it's that quickly.
Even if all the parents died out and it were just the children left?
I think we have something that looks a little bit more like "And the Children Shall Lead" from the original series.
Or Bonk Bonk on the Head. I expected a little more Bonk Bonk on the Head in this episode. I was disappointed.
Well, Zachary, my first pick, I'm just moving on, man. Well, Zachary, my first pick for Star Trek Enterprise Essentials Philosophy is the episode Dear Doctor, episode 13 of season 1. I find this really interesting. Well, first of all, let me hit on some of the highlights. First time chronologically that there's a mention of the Ferengi. We hear Ferengi the first time chronologically in the Star Trek universe. And the first hints of the Prime Directive. So I think those things, just in the value of this episode and the lore of Star Trek, I think make it valuable. But
we've made a distinction in the past on Metatreks between Star Trek that raises philosophical issues and philosophy within the Star Trek universe.
Yeah. Right?
The Prime Directive is philosophy within the Star Trek universe, Star Trek's own ethos,
yes,
the ethics of the Federation and whatnot. And those are interesting, but that's different than Star Trek raising philosophical issues.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. I just thought that, you know, within the ethos of the Star Trek universe, I think that makes this an interesting episode. But beyond that,
well, how did it come to become the Prime Directive, right? You know, what events led to its prominence, you know, that it's so important that it has this gravitas as being the Prime Directive.
Yeah. And so that's what Archer's wrestling with within the episode. He's faced with a conundrum, if you will, where there are two species living on this planet together. And Phlox discovers, as he's trying to find the origin and treat a disease, that the lesser of those species is actually in a state of evolution and could potentially become the dominant species on the planet. The Menk are really exploited by the Valakians, and so there's this push, if you will, to try and find a cure for this disease that the Valakians are facing that the Menk don't seem to be affected by. So Phlox is actually studying the Menk to find out what it is within the genome of the Menk that make them particularly unaffected by this deadly virus. And he finds within their genome the building blocks for, you know, kind of an evolution. But in order for that to happen, probably the Valakians are going to have to die off. And, you know, there's this real tug of war that happens within the episode that I find really interesting. And there's this, like, on the nose sort of ethical back and forth that happens between Phlox and Archer. Archer thinks, you know, Archer is very Kantian in the way that he approaches it. He's like, you're a doctor, you're supposed to help people. But Phlox is torn because he feels that he might be interfering in the natural selection of a species. And so I find that philosophically really interesting, what's going on between them and answering those questions. And Archer says in the episode, you know, one of these days we'll have a doctrine, you know, that will help us decide what to do in these situations. But until we get there, we just got to figure this out on our own. So philosophically, very interesting for me.
Well, it's culturally relevant. At this time period, it's right on the cusp of what's still continuing now, but what was rapid progress in genomics and genetic engineering. You know, these were still pretty new ideas in the early 2000s, right? You know, from 1990 to 2000, rapid progress happened, and now that's just been writ large. You know, we've got 20 more years of that progress now. Genetic engineering, genetic manipulation. You know, one thing that I've become fascinated by, again, you know, what's interesting to me is as I get older and as I think about more things that I'm interested in and make connections that I didn't used to make, is now I kind of waffle back and forth between pure philosophy and science and the interplay and interactions between the two. And one thing that I've always been interested in, more so now, is, and maybe stemming all the way back to the 90s with Jurassic Park, but de-extinction, you know, bringing extinct species back to life.
Right.
I've been reading about this, watching videos about this. Just as we're learning more about the evolution of our planet, and we can see some of these mass extinctions, we can, as we fleshed out more of these intermediate forms, we understand the natural evolution of our planet and that way more now than we did 20 years ago. And we can manipulate our genome, human genome, animal genomes. We're on the cusp of being able to turn one species into another species, right? Take a related species to an extinct species, modify its genome to be identical with the extinct species, and potentially bring the extinct species back to life by modifying an animal's genome. Not just cloning, but modifying an existing animal's genome. It's fascinating. But the moral weight of this is immense, and the ecological weight of this is immense, right? With this genetic engineering power we've got, you know, with microbiology and genetics, we have the power to control the destiny of the entire human species, any species on the planet we want to toy with, the ecology of the planet as a whole, or any alien species we come across, right? It's godlike power, where you have this power to control the destiny of an entire species or an entire world.
Absolutely.
And you could plausibly say that scientists get a little flippant with that responsibility. They start going, oh, we're just going to modify the genome, and we're going to do some cloning, we're going to reintroduce these animals into the environment. You go, oh my God, think about the consequences of what you're doing. The web of ecology is so complex, there's no way to predict what the consequences are going to be. And Jurassic Park, the movie, really, you know, drove that point home, that you can't predict the consequences of what you're going to do. The butterfly effect, as they put it in that movie.
Mm-hmm.
But arguably, you could say anyone with that power to you know, get in the weeds with someone's genome and, you know, tweak an entire species and alter that species' destiny is wielding godlike powers that maybe they shouldn't wield. And scientists don't necessarily always ask those ethical questions about what they're doing. But I think what's interesting to me culturally is that those ideas were still pretty new. Jurassic Park was only a few years old at this time period, right?
Yes.
You know, when did Jurassic Park come out? Early 90s. So, you know, 8 or 9 years before this, you know, not even a decade, right? And so we can see, I think this is just a great example of this natural consequence, is taking this new ability that we have to adjust our genome and manipulate the genes and the evolution of species around us. And starting to ask, wait a minute, you know, it sounds like a good idea, but what are the ethical principles involved? You know, should we do that? Should we not do that? You know, and how could you possibly predict the consequences enough to be reliable in any predictions you're going to make,
right,
and what the consequences are going to be? You could, you know, cause an ecological disaster in the entire planet for all you know.
Yeah.
You know, in doing that, it's a weighty responsibility that we don't hear about. We get excited. Oh, we're going to bring the woolly mammoths back to life, or we're going to bring the dinosaurs back to life, or we're going to bring the passenger pigeons back to life. That's the one I've become fascinated about, by the way, because I've always been a birder and a bird watcher and interested in birds and bird consciousness too. Read an interesting book about that. So yeah, there's some scientists that want to, you know, revive the extinct passenger pigeon. Imagine reintroducing 50 billion passenger pigeons into the environment, you know, 100 years after they went extinct, with all the change we have around us and the collapsing natural environments for some of these endangered bird species.
Right.
You know, you could wipe out 50 species in the process,
exactly,
of doing that. Why would you do that? You know, it's a really important question. But those are questions that were merely possible when this episode came out, that are way more possible now, 20 years later, than they were even then. So it's prescient that Enterprise was asking these kinds of questions, given that newfound ability that we have scientifically.
Yeah, I think it's incredible. And a great line in the episode, and I alluded to it earlier, you know, Captain Archer says, someday my people are going to come up with some sort of doctrine, something that tells us what we can and can't do out here, should and shouldn't do. But until somebody tells me that they've drafted that directive, I'm going to have to remind myself every day that we didn't come out here to play God. That's incredible. Mm-hmm. I love dialogue, and I just think that is such a great little piece of dialogue. And you're right, for the time period that this was written, I think it's light years ahead of anything that probably was on television at the time. So was this on your list, Zachary?
No, it wasn't, but I wish it were.
Well, what's next on your list?
I have the Andorian incident.
Ah, love that episode.
And I feel like I'm a bad philosopher here. Like, I'm having a hard time extracting robust themes out of these episodes. But I think what I like about this episode, in a way we already talked about it, but the Vulcans were almost always portrayed in a positive light. Vulcans are friends of the Federation, friends mm-hmm. of humans. Even if there's kind of a cultural misunderstanding between the two, generally there's a shared mission. But now we get to see Vulcans portrayed in not so good light. The Vulcans that lie, and the Vulcans that scheme, and the Vulcans that have a hidden agenda. And I think generally there's this cultural shift that was taking place in the 90s and in the early 2000s. In the 1980s, I think good and evil get portrayed in very black and white terms. You have the United States being a shining city on the hill, and you have Russia or the Soviet Union, the evil empire, as Ronald Reagan called it in the 80s, right? Good and evil were very simplistic in 1980s culture. You see that in TNG, definitely. And in the 90s, you get that eroding away. You get morality being more of shades of gray, more of these ethical dilemmas where it's not just a matter of good versus evil, good empire versus a bad empire. You get, you get a little bit of both. And so again, why is this interesting philosophically? I'm not sure it really is, but I like that Vulcans are portrayed in a different enough light where you stop pointing to Vulcans as like the epitome of a moral race. They're not a shining city on the hill for morality or rationality or whatever. Vulcans are faking it till they make it, just as much as humans are. But I think it just coincides with this cultural trend away from viewing good versus evil in ultra simplistic terms and viewing them, and which was a total artifact of the Cold War. I think you can trace that all the way from the 60s to the 80s in some way. But all of that started to fall apart in the 90s and 2000s. And now none of us think of morality that way. I think we don't have even about ourselves. We don't think of ourselves in these, with rose colored glasses like we did in the 80s compared to an evil empire like the Soviet Union. You know, there's some good people over there and some bad people over there. There's some good people over here and there's some bad people over here. And we recognize that now in a way that we didn't so much in 1980s culture. And this is just, I think, the tail end of that change that was taking place throughout the 1990s.
Yeah, I agree completely. The thing that I find fascinating about this episode, being a theologian, a church historian, I find it incredibly interesting the way the Vulcans were kind of hiding behind their religion. There's this clandestine monitoring facility, spy facility, if you will. I mean, it's literally right underneath their sacred monastery. It's like they're hiding behind, you know, the church, if you will. And so
that never happens.
I find it incredibly distasteful in such a great way for this episode. And I think it's very reminiscent of the way the Nazis kind of hid behind the Catholic Church in the 1930s, almost in debt with the Catholic Church to the point to where even post-World War II, the Catholic Church and the Red Cross were helping these war criminals get out of Dodge, as it were, or get out of Berlin, to be quite literal about it. But so I find it interesting. I find it interesting the way it's kind of on the nose, and the way that, you know, again, this is the early 2000s, and there is this there's this movement to integrate the Republican party into church and get the church involved more politically. And I'm not here to talk politics. I'm just saying that, you know, it is what it is. And as a church pastor myself, I'm a full-time pastor. I tell tell my folks all the time, you know, listen, be careful about getting involved in partisan politics. Neither of these guys are always representing our values in an effective way. So I think it's interesting that they kind of hit that nail right on the head with this. And certainly Shadows of Bajem episode 15 later on in the season, I think those two episodes go together quite well. I think they really kind of dig up a really interesting ethical bone.
Well, I think you're right. There's something distasteful about using religion as a mask for politics, or as a mask for a political agenda, or as a mask for, in this case, it's espionage, or pick your favorite, fill in the blank, religion as a mask for something else. There's something somewhat offensive about that in general that this episode's hitting on. I'm not sure what it has to say about it, other than the fact that, you know, that, you know, religion can be a front for a great many other things. You know, is there a deeper point to it than that?
Yeah, I don't think there's a deeper point to it than that. But I think it raises some really interesting questions that I think anyone who's interested in religion or spirituality, I think should take the time to sit down and watch and ponder. When you're at the beginning of the episode, you're almost infuriated at these filthy Andorians kicking the door open, and you know they come, you know, hustling in there like, you know, a bunch of six-gun cowboys. And, you know, you're like, what the heck?
Andorian cowboys.
Yeah,
I love it.
Andorian cowboys. Yeah. This is, but, you know, Shram the Andorian cowboy busting in and wrecking the place and, you know, smacking the priests around. And, you know, you're thinking, you know, how disgusting. But the reality is, Zachary, the disgusting thing was what was going on right below them, in using this as a front for a spy facility. I agree with you. I'm not sure exactly what it's saying, but I think it raises
we're going to offend someone, but you almost can't help that when you talk about these topics.
Right? Yeah.
Someone's going to be offended by it, and that's okay.
Yeah.
But that happens in this day and age. You know, there are politicians and people with a political agenda and
without
this, that,
and
the other form that directly appealed what we call the religious right. You know, appealing to religion in the name of something else, or having some hidden agenda all in the name of something ostensibly positive. And there are deep sort of hidden connections between those things that are opaque unless you start looking for those connections and seeing the way in which something that is kind of idealistic, a spiritual life or religion or whatever, that is abused or misused or connected with something that has less pure ideals than that. And it's, you know, there's a dark web of those things, and, you know, culturally that should be drawn attention to.
Yeah.
I think
my Christian worldview literally informs every aspect of my life. There's nothing that isn't influenced by my faith, by my worldview as a Christian. But that being said, I'm incredibly offended when people hide behind, and not just a Christian center, but, you know, just religion in general, just use that as something to hide behind while they, you know, lob these kind of political underhanded sort of agendas. And I just, you know, I'm disgusted by it. I think this is a great commentary on just how disgusting that is. Again, I'm not entirely sure what, you know, philosophically they're totally trying to say in the episode, but it does raise a lot of interesting questions.
Well, it just shows that, I mean, to some extent, there you can kind of take this postmodern reading of it, where the things that look like they're good and virtuous, you know, are actually the exact opposite. You know, the Andorians look like they're coming in guns blazing, but really they're the good guys in this tale. And Vulcans, of course, they're the good guys.
Yes.
Until you realize that they've got a spy facility under their sacred monastery. Oh, wait a minute. You know, they're not the good guys.
A bunch of slime balls.
Yeah. You know, it's taking those meta narratives, you know, in this case, it would be cultural meta narratives, and decomposing them and deconstructing them and seeing them through opposite lenses. But we do that all the time, you know. I mean, each side thinks that the other side is the bad guy, right? So, you know, if you put yourself in their shoes, you can identify with them a lot more. We know that now, but I guess that's what I find interesting about the episode, this kind of interesting twist on who's the good guy and who's the bad guy, and what that means for this more postmodern view of the distinction between good and evil.
Yeah, great pick. Great pick. So next on my list, Zachary, is season one's bottle episode. And not because it features Dorton's best Kentucky bourbon. But Shuttlepod 1 is next on my list. It is episode 16 in season 1. I love this because it contrasts, and I feel bad because it's not incredibly philosophical, but I love the contrast between kind of this optimistic point of view and this pessimistic. I mean, Reed's almost the point of being a nihilist in this episode. It's like, well, there's no point in life. There's no purpose. He's such a pessimist. It's like beyond pessimism.
I signed up for an adventure, and here I am going to die in a shell graph, not even a year into it. Yes. Darn it. You know, yes. What's the meaning of any of it?
Yeah, yes. I get it. Yes. I don't know. There are moments in the episode I think that are Cartesian in ways. The whole episode, I think, is really fascinating. By the way, they call it a bottle episode because, you know, low budgets, they just, you know, everything happens just kind of in the shuttle pod. There are only a couple of really quick scenes that take place on the bridge of...
cheap to film.
Yeah, cheap to film.
It saves money for stuff they're going to make later in the episode.
Yeah,
or later in the season.
Later in the season. But I love the contrast, you know, between Tucker's, you know, a bit more optimistic and Reed's very pessimistic. You know, he's dealing
Reed
with...
Reed pessimistic?
Reed
really?
Very pessimistic. You know,
never.
Captain Kirk says famously in The Wrath of Khan, how we deal with death is at least as important as how we deal with life. And I find that really on display in this because in Shuttle Pod 1, a micro-singularity causes all kinds of damage to the shuttle pod that Reed and Tucker are in. And, you know, they only have, you know, just days worth of oxygen before they're dead. And they are having to literally try to decide whether they're going to, you know, take a chance and buy themselves an extra few hours to find a unlikely solution of survival, or, you know, do they just try to settle to make themselves comfortable in the end? And I find the dialogue very rich. I think their conversations are very philosophical as they try to wrestle with their own chances of survival and facing, you know, the imminent reality that they're probably going to die in the shuttle pod, trying to decide whether or not it's pointless to shave, and, you know, these letters that Reed's writing to, you know, all of his lost loves, and, you know, dealing with his own disappointment that, you know, that he's never really gotten close to anyone in life, and he was just starting to settle in and feel at home. And they talk about their feelings towards Archer. I think the dialogue has these really wonderful little moments, if you will, that I think that are philosophical. The episode as a whole, not terribly so, but I just love the subtle contrast between these two characters and, you know, all of these great little ethical questions that come up about their own pending doom.
Well, it's a good personality litmus test, right? I mean, you think of people who have cancer and going to die soon, or they know they have 10 days left or 6 weeks left or whatever it is.
Yeah.
How you approach that situation reveals a lot about who you really are,
yes.
Probably.
Yes.
Your inner nature gets revealed in that kind of situation in ways that maybe doesn't in ordinary day-to-day life. If you're an optimist, you're going to be an optimist, you know, even till the very end. If you're kind of a pessimist, you're going to be a pessimist till the very end. And I think it just magnifies that essential quality of your personality and amplifies it.
Yeah. Yeah. Again, just, you know, dialogue, I think, really, really drove this. Nothing really stands out. It's just a great little slice of life kind of episode, I think, that asks a lot of little interesting philosophical questions, because they do wax kind of philosophical as they're dealing with whether or not they're going to live or die, and what's appropriate and what's not appropriate, and who's going to sacrifice. And, you know, in one scene in the episode, Tucker's going to, you know, basically climb up into a hatch. And so Reed stands a chance of living longer. And, you know, this is a case of the needs of the one are more important than the needs of the one.
Well, yeah, it's not really a trolley problem, right?
Exactly.
It's one versus one. It's just one versus one, right? Do I commit suicide, or do you commit suicide so the other can live? Flip a coin, right? It's how do you decide such a thing?
And in some ways, it's kind of, you know, this episode is like an interesting sort of take on Schrodinger's cat. It's just like on one hand, you know, they're dead. They're already dead. In the end, they end up doing something very reminiscent of the original series, the Galileo 7. They jettison and ignite the impulse engine, you know, sacrificing their hope that they'll have an engine to get them home in hopes that somebody will see the explosion and help will arrive.
And by golly, they did.
Yes, by golly, they did.
As luck would have it. You
know, how does
it was
it,
in the script.
How does it feel to be going slower than a snail? You know? I just find that exploration of self-discovery very satisfying, I think, philosophically. But even more than that, I love the episode. I love these types of episodes. And it's true of Dear Doctor, too. I think the thing that I like about Dear Doctor, it's a very dialogue-driven. It's a letter. I like it when they did it in TNG with Data. I always like these kind of episodes. I loved it when they did it with Tom Paris and Voyager. So yeah, I like those kind of dialogue-driven, you know, get inside my head and really understand who I am as a person.
Well, yeah, it's the Socratic dictum, know thyself, right? I mean, that's essentially what we're talking about.
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
Which, and maybe having, you know, death be imminent is one of the best ways to get to know yourself in a hurry.
Without a doubt. So, Zachary, what's next on your list?
So next on my list, maybe in keeping with this existential theme of knowing oneself, Breaking the Ice, where T'Pol basically has to choose between staying on the Enterprise and doing the socially acceptable thing in her own tradition and her own culture, back on Vulcan. There's not a deep reason. I just think it's one of these great examples of an existential choice, right? T'Pol has to decide who she is and what matters for her life and make a decision and act on it. And I think life is full of hard decisions like that, right? And T'Pol has to make a hard decision to stay on the Enterprise. And ultimately she chooses to stay on the Enterprise because that's who she is.
Yeah.
And that means, and I think everyone as they grow up has these kinds of kumbaya moments with themselves, right? Where they get to commune with themselves and figure out who they really are. And a lot of time that means being different from your tradition or your religion or your culture or your family or whatever it is, for the sake of being authentic. And T'Pol just has to realize at a certain point that she's not like every other Vulcan.
Yeah. Yeah. You were talking earlier about, you know, major arcing themes in this first season. And I think you hit it right there a moment ago. I think that this kind of existential exploration is really, I think, dominant, probably more so in season one of Enterprise than I've probably seen it as an arcing theme. I think that there are episodes out there in some of the other series, but you know, to kind of dominate the overall storytelling in a season, I think that there's this really kind of great arcing theme of existentialism that dominates this season. And this is a great episode here, Breaking the Ice, for T'Pol. I think another one that I can lump with that is actually my honorable mention, which is Fusion, you know, where she's very blatantly trying to explore who she is as a Vulcan and, you know, trying to find her way, you know, on this human ship. And you know, what does that mean for her? So, it was just Breaking the Ice is just such a great character building episode where she's, you know, again, asking some of those very basic fundamental questions.
Well, season one of Enterprise is asking that very same question about the Federation as a whole.
I guess
the Federation hasn't even happened yet. Starfleet. What is Starfleet going to be in this galactic melting plot? Mm-hmm. What is the Federation eventually going to be? And we get to see the formation of the Federation by the time Enterprise wraps up. And it's similar to what we see in season one of Discovery as well, which is asking that same question. What is the Klingon Empire going to be in the face of the change that the Klingon Empire is going through? What is Starfleet and the Federation? What are Starfleet and the Federation going to be in response to this increasingly galactic environment that the Federation is in, where there are clashes and border conflicts and whatnot. What values emerge? What principles, like the Prime Directive or other principles that we see in Star Trek, ethical or political or whatnot. All of those I would lump in with these existential questions. Individuals ask them about themselves, but societies have to answer those questions too. The society that we see in the 23rd and 24th centuries or 22nd century here, just as much as we do, I think, either on an individual level or at a societal level.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I was actually going to save it for the end, but I think along the same lines I mentioned, my honorable mention was fusion. You know, the thing that I find fascinating about this episode is, you know, in the midst of trying to explore her own curious nature, and I think we're trying to establish that Vulcans suppress that sense of curiosity. T'Pol, on the other hand, is a natural explorer, and so she finds herself driven by her curiosity. And so in Fusion, we have, you know, we have this kind of interesting little group of Vulcans that she's able to meet. And you know, within that episode, we see the first chronological use of a mind meld, which at the time is very uncommon, and there's a lot of taboo linked to it among Vulcans. And T'Pol essentially is raped through a mind meld. I think that this is the Me Too episode of Star Trek Enterprise. You know, she's dealing with, you know, having been, you know, a victim, and they carry this over in several episodes in later seasons in very wonderful ways. But, you know, she's wrestling with her own philosophy, and she meets this group of Vulcans that aren't like the rest of the Vulcans that T'Pol knows. And I love the fact that, very early on, we're establishing that she's not, you know, she's not one of these, you know, TNG era evolved, you know, pasty kind of Vulcans, but you know, she's Vulcans. but she's on this, you know, kind of journey of discovery of her own. You know, she's asking those existential questions. Well, and
I would say T'Pol, correct me if I'm wrong, I would say generally T'Pol asks questions about herself that most Vulcans don't ask, maybe with the exception of someone like Spock, but maybe even more so than Spock. Spock seems to take a lot of Vulcan culture just for granted. In fact, he's chosen it in a way, right?
I don't know if she does it more so, though. I think we see in a much smaller way, I think Tuvok has a similar, you know, experience during the seven seasons we get of Voyager.
The only thing that happens to Tuvok in seven seasons is that he learns how to dance. Neelix finally gets him to cut a rug.
If that's what you can call
that.
That's
the only development he's got in 7 years. I don't know which series you were watching.
Yeah. No, but you know, going back and reliving and remembering his youth and when he was a bit more rebellious and
yeah, that's,
you know,
true.
How that can inform him in his life now.
But that's a matter of him choosing to be Vulcan. And Spock basically does the same move, right?
Sure.
Spock chooses his Vulcan culture over his human culture generally. And Tuvok, you know, basically rejects the rebelliousness and, you know, emotional drives of his youth consciously once he's been made aware of them, you know, by his Vulcan master teacher that he was, you know, in, I don't know how to, he was banished to. I'm not sure exactly how to describe that. But T'Pol's making the opposite choice in a way. You know, she's still Vulcan, but she incorporates aspects of humanity into herself in ways that even Spock doesn't do.
Yeah, I agree with that. To the episode that you mentioned, Breaking the Ice, it was on your list. You know, I think that is a more external representation of an internal conflict. You know, that has to do with, you know, her breaking traditions. Am I going to stick with the traditions of my people? Am I going to do, you know, what my parents have obligated me to do and be a, you know, as they say, a good Vulcan girl and, you know, go home and marry and have little Vulcan babies? And, you know, am I going to do that? Or am I going to do something different with my life? And she's still wrestling with that. And she wrestles with that in Fusion, but in a much more internal way. And it causes her to explore that, you know, in a very reckless way, in a way that ultimately causes her years of physical, emotional, and spiritual damage. And I think it's a cautionary tale, you know, when we're trying to figure out our own existential crisis, to be cautious how we explore those questions and where we try to get those answers from, because not everyone out there has our best interest in mind.
Well, there's a healthy, authentic way of being a unique individual as opposed to your culture, or your tradition, or your family, and then there's a self-destructive way of doing that.
Sure. Right?
And you know, obviously, the healthy, authentic ways are usually better than the self-destructive ways.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. So that's great. So, Zachary, my last pick on my list of essential Trek philosophy is the episode Detained. That is episode 21 of season 1. I love this episode for a lot of reasons, and I think by and large it's reminiscent of what happened during World War II when Japanese Americans were sent to internment camps. This was one of those episodes that Mike Sussman hated, but frankly, I love it. I love this episode because I think it asks a lot of really interesting questions. This is one of those episodes, I think, that was heavily influenced by 9/11 when...
And way more relevant now than it was 20 years ago, I would say, given
without
what's
a
happening
doubt.
In our country now.
Without a doubt. You know, we were dealing with, you know, post 9/11, we were dealing with, Islamophobia, in horrible proportions. And, really, I think,
but
I
we
think
weren't rounding anyone up, you know,
no, but
like we are now.
Yeah, without a doubt. But, you know, I think that we were definitely headed down that road in a much greater, in a much greater velocity than we are even now. But I think this was relevant, you know, in 2002 when it aired. I think it's relevant now. The thing that's interesting, you know, the Suliban are being rounded up by the Tendarans. You know, Colonel Gratt is rounding them up. He's putting them in internment camps because there are Suliban that are part of a militant group, a group of terrorists called the Cabal. And
yeah, Suliban sounds a lot like Taliban.
Yes, it does.
No accident there.
I don't think there's an accident.
No, there's of course it's not.
Yeah.
It's,
I think it was heavily influenced by September 11th. I think that the naming was very purposeful. I think the story is very purposeful. The fact that you do have, you know, this cabal, this terrorist organization, you have the rounding up of innocent Suliban just because they look like the Suliban that are part of the cabal. And this whole camp, this whole operation... again, you know, I sound like a broken record, but it's distasteful to watch.
And again, you know, the linguistic connections are either a happy accident or subtle and brilliant, right? Suliban, Taliban. We have Cabal, Quran. Like, you know, the linguistic patterns are too numerous to be accidental.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
I do think it's very on the nose in that regard. Yeah. And Islamophobia was rampant at that time.
Yeah, so mm-hmm. ethically, I find it very interesting because, unfortunately, I don't think we've learned the lessons we should have learned from post Pearl Harbor America. At least in this country, we've not learned those lessons. We should.
Well, whenever you generalize and say, you know, let's be afraid of the entire group because there's a few bad eggs, yeah. you know, you're headed down a bad path.
Yeah, without a doubt. So philosophically, I find this interesting and I find it relevant. I find it timely.
So you mentioned you have some honorable mentions, which I don't have. I really struggled to put enough episodes on my list, so I didn't come up with any honorable mentions. I love the main picks you've got. What else do you have?
Yeah, so the honorable mention that I had was Fusion. That was my only honorable mention.
Mm-hmm.
I mentioned earlier Terra Nova was kind of on my long list. And as far as the other picks that you had, Zachary, that's just the thing. I love Enterprise, and I love this first season in terms of the entertainment value and the storytelling. I love it. I just think philosophically it's kind of light. It's these wonderful little nuggets and these overarching themes that, you know, that you find. But, you know, to take an episode and say, you know, this is really interesting philosophically, I just didn't have a lot of that. Little bits and pieces, little bite here, a little crumb there.
Let me put it this way. Getting back to the history of philosophy, you could point to something like Plato's Republic and say, what an idealistic vision of an ideal society you came up with, Plato. Then Aristotle came along and said, what a great, completely impractical, idealistic vision. Let me show you how it's really done practically. That's what Aristotle had to say. I think Enterprise is the Aristotle to all of Star Trek's Plato. Star Trek presents an idealistic vision of the future of mankind. But the immediate criticism is, that's not plausible, that's not possible, it's too idealistic, human nature is not like that. What Enterprise is trying to do is, so, no, let me lay out the roadmap for how we're going to get there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's maybe its practical value. It has this sort of practical value. It brings Star Trek out of the Platonic heaven into the realm of the ordinary for us, you know, 21st century humans that want to have a better society than the one we have.
Yeah. My hat's off to Brandon Praga, and I'd still love to get him here on the show, but my hat's off to Brandon Braga. He was able to still give us an optimistic Star Trek while wading through, I think, some very difficult waters in a Star Trek universe that was in its infancy with salty humans and Andorian cowboys and pasty Vulcans and still managed to give us this really great, kind of optimistic Star Trek. I love Enterprise. I can't say enough about it.
And it's interesting to see how that approach to storytelling gets resurrected nowadays in like the Orville, for example.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned, you know, as we look forward with more Star Trek, essential Trek philosophy, we've got definitely more seasons. We're at the end of Enterprise. There will be no more Enterprise essential Trek philosophy, Zachary. This is it.
More is the pity. I like to think about the three seasons of Enterprise that could have been had Enterprise not been canceled.
Yes, yes. But that being said, there's plenty of new Star Trek on the horizon, as it were. And so I'm looking forward to that. We still need to do an essentials for season two of Discovery. We need to put that definitely on the schedule, I think, coming up. And I'm really looking forward. You know, this is a Star Trek that looks backward, and I love that. But, you know, I'm looking forward to the new Star Trek on the horizon and looking forward to essential philosophies from Picard. And this is a great time to be a Star Trek fan.
I think we do need to do a better job of incorporating current, contemporary, up-and-coming Star Trek into our Metatrex episodes.
Without a doubt.
Well, Mike, after our closing thoughts, do you want to give a recap of our choices for essential Trek philosophy from Enterprise Season 1?
Yeah,
we've got Star Trek Enterprise Season 1, as it came to be known later.
Well, Zachary, I've got here on the list Terra Nova, Dear Doctor, The Andorian Incident, Shuttlepod 1, Breaking the Ice, Detained, and our honorable mention, Fusion. And that, listeners, is Enterprise Essential Trek Philosophy Season 1.
Maybe not the most philosophically rich season of Star Trek in all of Star Trek history, but one of the most enjoyable nonetheless. Well, it's been fun talking about Andorian cowboys today, but this isn't the only thing we've been discussing here on the network. So here's a quick look at some of the other things you may have missed elsewhere on Trek.fm.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
I bought it when it first came out. I played it for like 2 or 3 days, and I went, "What is going on? Am I missing something? Is just I'm not a good player." So, and then I checked on the reviews online, and everyone agreed that it was not a good game, and we were all correct.
Literary Treks.
But that's why I bring this back around, why it was so cool, the Klingon battlecruisers, to distinguish them not being the smooth-sided, cheapy little things from the series. Gene gives them this, you know, never is this uttered on screen, but every little tech nerd knows what a Katinga, you know, Klingon battlecruiser is. And it's only because Gene came up with that word and gave it to them in the novel. It's not in the movie. You know, nobody says, "Captain, we were picking up three Klingon Takinga heavy battlecruisers on the, you know, Epsilon 9.
Earl Grey.
Come on. Like, when you go on a date, you're going out to dinner and you're, that's like the standard date number one, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like, maybe things are different in the 24th
maybe.
Century.
Maybe.
But okay, all right.
I mean, you could be assuming this is the first time they shared breakfast together.
Maybe. That's a wild assumption.
Maybe they're that, right.
And introducing our newest show, The Line, a Star Trek Picard podcast.
Mike, I wanted to make a comment about something that you said about being mostly the middle for a lot of these comic book franchises. It actually makes me think Star Trek, in a way, is something that keeps going and going, 764 installments now, without a specific end necessarily. Maybe it'll come someday. But
These are the Voyages was a love letter to the fans. What are you talking about, Justin?
You know what I mean.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out all these shows and join the conversation about your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button in Apple Podcasts on your iPhone, iPad, Apple TV, or the desktop iTunes app to get the latest episodes as soon as they're published. And please leave us a star rating and a written review. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Google Play Music, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and most third-party podcast apps, and you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website or grab the RSS link as well. Well, we'd love to hear your thoughts on today's episode of MetaTreks, and there are many ways for you to mind-meld with us. The best place to join in the larger conversation is the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type Babel, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, and it should come right up. If you'd like to send us an email, you can use the contact form on our website at trek.fm/contact. Choose Message to a Trek FM Show and select MetaTreks. That will come right to us. You can also find the network on Twitter at TrekFM and on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. Well, Mike, speaking of forbidden mind melds, where can our listeners mind meld with you on the interwebs and around the Trek FM network?
Well, Zachary, you can always find me on Facebook. That's where I'm most active. I'm also on Twitter. My Twitter handle is at cmichael1701. Instagram is cmichael1701. You can also catch me over on my website. It's cmichaelmorrison.com or hannahgoodhart.com. And Zachary, when you're not riding the range with a bunch of Andorian cowboys, where can our listeners find you around the interwebs and on Trek FM?
Well, you can find me elsewhere on Trek.fm as co-host of To the Journey, a Trek FM show dedicated to Star Trek Voyager. You can always find me in the Babel Conference if you'd like to talk about Star Trek and philosophy with me in there. And you're welcome to follow me on Twitter. My handle is just my name, at Zachary Frueling.
You know, Zachary, I do have a new headcanon. I'm an ELO fan, Electric Lights Orchestra, right?
Okay.
I have this vision of Shran with his Walkman, getting ready to bust that door open, listening to ELO's Wild West Hero.
Okay, I see it. That might be the most out there headcanon we've heard. Well, if you'd like to help us keep all of our shows coming to you each week, you can become a patron of the network on Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm to get all the details. Perks include early access to episodes, exclusive content, producer credits, and many more, all available through our special patrons website, the Patron Zone. It requires a great deal of time and money to produce, host, and distribute these podcasts each month. We really appreciate any support you can give us, and we hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. Well, we'd like to take a moment to acknowledge the rest of the Metatrex team from around the network. Specifically, we'd like to thank C. Brian Jones, the founder and publisher of Trek.fm, and a loyal supporter of Dorton's Kentucky Bourbon.
Not a sponsor.
Not a sponsor. Unpaid promotion here. Our executive producers, Matthew Rushing and Ken Tripp, Aaron Harvey, our art director, and Richard Marquez, our production manager. We'd also like to give a thank you and a shout out to our associate producers here on Metatrex. We'd like to thank Patrick Devlin. You can find Patrick at MagicDrop5, Kay Shaw at Choco Weeble, Norman Lau at Starfighter1701, and Mark Walker at Mark74656, a good Voyager Twitter handle. And Mike, we'd like once more to invite our listeners to discover more about our sponsor, Enterprise in Space, a project of the nonprofit National Space Society. Visit enterpriseinspace.org to find out more and to get your seat on the mission. And check out audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for your desktop or mobile device. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. Well, everyone, thanks for listening to Metatrex, a Star Trek and philosophy podcast. Until next time, when we will once again boldly go where no philosophers have gone before. And no beagles.